the course economic reasoning. Now I have the difficult task in this course. I'm going to try to convince you that thinking about economics is easy. Now, if any of you have gone to my previous courses, you'll see it's a very difficult task because my lectures tend to be complicated, but this course, which I'm intending to be much easier than some of the others. If you haven't had any background in economics, you'll be able to understand this quite readily, at least if I'm doing my job properly. Now, we have two textbooks for the course. One is the great classic by Henry Hazlitt called Economics in One Lesson. Now, this is a very easy book to read. It was one that Ludwig von Mises used as a textbook in his undergraduate course at New York University. It's one of the great classics of economics. And the other book is my own Introduction to Economic Reasoning. I should tell you, I wrote that Introduction to Economic Reasoning, I intended it as a textbook for high school students. A lot of people have found it hard to follow, so you don't have to pay as much attention to that one. The one really to concentrate on is the Henry Hazlitt one. It was a long time ago since I wrote the Introduction to Economic Reasoning. I know it was a long time ago because I remember when it was published, I just turned 50, and that was quite some time ago. Now, one thing about how the mechanics of this course work, I generally lecture for about an hour or so, and then we have about half hour for questions where you can type in things in the chat box, and I'll try to answer them or evade them as seems most reasonable. And you can also type in questions during the lecture in the chat or observations, but I don't always answer those. It just depends on if I happen to see them or if I'm in the middle of something, I might postpone it to later. And then there is going to be, for those of you who are interested in taking the course for a grade, I have weekly quizzes. There are multiple choice quizzes, 10 questions. I try to make these easy on the order of who, if you can answer questions like who is buried in Grant's tomb, you'll be able to deal with my quizzes pretty easily. So we have to, just before getting into lecture, I thought I'd pass on to you an observation from Jan Narveson. Said a definition of an economist. An economist is someone who doesn't have the personality to be an accountant. So I think with that we can get on to the course. Now, if you have studied any neoclassical or mainstream economics, the kind of economics you'll get if you take a regular university course at one of the major universities, there's a very big difference between the way mainstream economics operates and the way Austrian economics operates. The type of economics we're doing in this course is Austrian economics. The economics was developed by Ludwig von Mises and continued by Murray Rothbard, a lot of names I'm sure you're familiar with. Henry Hazlitt was in the Austrian economy. And what is the difference? Well, one thing that makes it much more fun to study Austrian economics than neoclassical economics is that mainstream economics is very hard to understand. I just see one question, how long is each class? Well, the total time is an hour and a half. And as I said, I give usually about an hour for the lecture and then half hour for questions. That's not fixed and variable. That way it usually works out. So as I say, mainstream economics is hard to understand. And why is it? Well, what the standard way of proceeding in neoclassical economics is economists will construct a mathematical model. And sometimes the math that you have to learn is to understand these is quite difficult. And why do they do that? Well, this is the way they can be very exact in what they're working on. They just specify certain axioms, and then they prove theorems with these axioms. And then if they've done the math right, then the theorems will follow from the axiom. So they think, well, if they do it that way, they can get a very exact model, but there's no, if they've done it right, there isn't any room for ambiguity or differences in meaning. People won't be quarreling over what the model says. It's very clear in the math. Of course, the problem with that is, well, they can show what follows from certain axioms, but how do we know that the axioms are true? They're just selecting certain axioms that they'll find convenient to develop their model. Then they want to know how do they find out whether these models are true? How do we know they apply to reality? You can construct a very exact model, but how do you know it applies to reality? So the way they find that out, they'll say, well, they can produce certain predictions from their model. They'll say something like, our model will show that the price of a certain good will rise by such and such an amount under certain conditions. And they can just test out whether that applies. Now, the problem that comes in here that makes neoclassical economics even more difficult to understand. Remember, it's difficult because it involves math and constructing models, sometimes very difficult math, is the testing of these predictions also very often involves math. They use fairly complicated statistical methods, so you have to all know all sorts of things about regressions and other things like that. It's a good thing I don't have to teach that class. I couldn't do it. Whether I can do this is something that remains to be determined, but I definitely couldn't do that. So, further, just one point, where mainstream economics is very different from the way Austrian economics does things, is some mainstream economics think that what's important is only whether the model we're using gives true prediction. So according to some mainstream economists, it doesn't really matter if your axioms are true or perfectly right. If they can come up with predictions that turn out correct, then you got a useful model. And there was a famous article by Milton Friedman, who was a Nobel Prize winner in economics and strong supporter of the free market, but definitely not an Austrian economist. So he wrote a famous article called The Methodology of Positive Economics, and he said, you don't have to worry about whether the axioms of the model are true. All you can care about are the predictions. And Friedrich Hayek, who's one of the greatest Austrian economists, said this is an extremely dangerous article. He thought this was terrible that he said that, but that's a view that's very popular among mainstream economists. Now, the Austrian view that we'll be doing in this course is very different from that. Remember, the view that mainstream has is, at least a lot of mainstream economists, we're trying to have an exact mathematical model, and then we test out the predictions of the model, see if they're right. And we don't really have to be that concerned over whether the assumptions, the axioms of the model are true. What we're interested in is coming up with true predictions. So that'll be the way we know that the model really applies to reality. Now, the Austrian view is different. What would be the reason, or one of the reasons, the Austrians don't construct mathematical models? Well, according to the Austrian view, if you work things out mathematically, you don't really understand why the proposition is true. Say you have a certain equation and you solve it according to certain rules you've learned in your math class, you can just go through this mechanically. You don't really grasp why each step is true. You just know if you apply certain rules, you'll come up with a correct answer mathematically, but you don't have a certain kind of understanding of what's going on. This actually is a criticism. Hegel made this criticism of Newton. He thought Newton's physics doesn't really enable you to understand what's going on. He's like Kepler. That doesn't have any real relevancy to economics. I'm just throwing that in and just to show I know a little bit about history, philosophy, why not? Might as well throw it in. But you see, just a similar kind of criticism that if you really understand what's going on, you have to reason in ordinary language, so you're not just following certain rules mechanically. You understand what is really going on at each step. And this is one reason that Austrian economics is easier than the neoclassical economics, because you're understanding what's going on each step of the way. Basically, Austrian would say we're understanding each step. So what specifically do we have to understand? Well, the basic principle that we start with is that we all act. Each of us is an actor. By that I don't mean that we're interested in getting into the theater or motion pictures, but we're acting in the sense of doing things. We're using means to achieve ends. Say, you want to relearn something about economics, so you read Henry Hazlitt's book. So your end is to learn something about economics. You have a means of doing that, to read that book. So you're acting in that way, you're using means to achieve your end. So the key to Austrian economics is that if we think about what's involved in the concept of action, we can discover important truths about economics. So we think about what's involved in the concept of action, particular kinds of action. Just think about that, and we come up with important truths about economics. And I'd like to start off by giving an example of a very important truth in economics that we can get just by thinking about things. So instead of just talking about what the Austrian method is, we'll be able to see it in action. Now, we want to ask, suppose you have any kind of exchange, like I'm trading apples, I have apples, you have oranges, so I want to exchange apples for oranges, and you agree to make such an exchange. We have exchanges all the time in economics, where people are always exchanging things. Now, we ask, on what condition would an exchange take place, any exchange, not just oranges and apples, I'm just using this as an example. Well, suppose I have apples and I want oranges, so why would I trade apples for oranges? Well, obviously I want the oranges more than the apples, otherwise I wouldn't trade. If I'd rather have my apples than your oranges, I'm not going to engage in any trade. And on the other side, that you have oranges and you're willing to trade them for my apples, you'd rather have apples than oranges. Otherwise, we wouldn't make the trade. So in any trade, each person prefers what he's getting to what he's giving up. Otherwise, there would be no trade. There'd be no point in making the trade if I preferred apples to oranges, well, then I'm not going to trade any, I'm not going to trade apples for oranges. It's a very easy point to grasp. So every exchange involves a double inequality. In the example I gave, I value oranges more than apples, and you value apples more than oranges. So here it's a very simple point, but by thinking about it, we see how the Austrian method proceeds. So what we're doing is we're just thinking in an everyday way, just a kind of common sense way, about what an exchange involves. We're not using any complicated math. We're not running any statistical regressions. We're just thinking, well, what do we need to make sense of an exchange? And I see kind of double coincidence at once. Yes, this is that's quite right, and that's what's involved. It's we have, but what this we have to realize is the coincidence at once involves an inequality, because I prefer what I'm getting to what I'm giving up, and you also prefer that. It's reverse preferences. Otherwise, there's no exchange. Now, once you think about it, it's an obvious point. It doesn't require, as Hans Hoppe likes to say about things, you don't have to be Einstein to understand this. Tom Woods does a very good impression of Hoppe saying that. But Mises points out that many very famous thinkers missed that. They thought that in an exchange there has to be equality. Aristotle thought that exchange requires equality. He thought if apples are exchanging for oranges, then there has to be some kind of equality between apples and oranges. And very famously, Karl Marx, when he was developing his labor theory of capital, especially in his great book, Das Kapital, first volume, 1867, he, the basis of his labor theory of value, which is the basic theory in the book, is that exchange involves an equality. And he takes this in a very strong sense, that Marx has thought, and it's an equality in fact that the two items exchanged are somehow identical. And how are they identical? They have a similar, they have the same number of labor hours. So he's saying, you, in order to have an exchange, you have to have an equality of labor hours. But if you just think about it, you don't need an equality. What you in fact have is a double inequality. I'm just going to note a footnote here that I'm not going to go into, because remember, this is the easy course. There's a complication here that I'm not going to go into. If you really want to refute the labor theory of value, you need to add another step, but I won't give that now because it's a bit more difficult. Maybe somebody wants to ask me about this discussion, we can go into it. But the basic point is that a lot of thinkers have mistakenly thought that economic exchange requires an equality, but in fact it can only take place if there's a double inequality. I have to prefer what I'm getting to what I'm giving up. If you're trading me, you prefer what you're getting to what you're giving up. And this, since we're trading, we have the opposite preferences. Now, what we've just done, this where we're trying to figure out and say, well, what is involved in the notion of exchange? And we say, well, in order to make sense of an exchange, we have to think that there's this double inequality. Here's an example of deductive reasoning. So we say we're asking, what do we need to make sense of an exchange? I'm making sense. What's involved in understanding the concept of an exchange? we think about that, we see how exchange requires a double inequality. I see somebody's added a comment here, Brazil, 99% of social science are egalitarian. Well, that's unfortunate for the Brazilian, but I think it just makes a cycle. When you say somebody's an egalitarian, that means something like they favor equal distribution of wealth. But what we're talking about now, when we talk about equality, that's something else. That just says that when you're making an exchange, that people who believe that exchange involves equality think that the value of the goods exchange has to be the same. So somebody could hold that and say the value just has to be the same in any exchange, and they could be quite inegalitarian in their social views. They say, well, we think it's perfectly fine that, say, there's this master class that's exploiting slaves, but in any economic exchange, there isn't, has to be equality. So that would be sort of the different sense of equality, you see. But as I say, what we're doing here, we're thinking, for example, deductive reasoning, because we're saying, what do we need to understand this concept of exchange? We're just trying to draw out what's involved in the concept. So if we've done this correctly, then the results are true, because we're just expanding on the meaning of the concept exchange. We're not making some kind of hypothesis. We're not saying, well, if we look at exchanges, we're going to find that there's this double inequality. We're just asking what's involved in the concept. And when we think about it, we see any exchange has to have that characteristic, namely that there's a double inequality. Now, in deductive reasoning, generally, what we're doing is we're moving from premises to conclusion. Now, premises here are the statements that you're starting with. I don't mean premises in the sense of places where you live. You know, I remember there was a cartoon that showed two people who were across the street, and each one is in the balcony of his house, and they're engaging in a big argument. They're having a big argument. You can see them yelling at each other across the street, and the caption is arguing from different premises. You must laugh at this point. That was a joke. So here what we mean by premises are just the starting points, the statements you're starting with. And so if you reason correctly according to the rules of logic correctly, then your conclusion is true. So to give the most famous of all examples of reasoning, the syllogism, say all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Now, supposing these two premises are true, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, then we can conclude Socrates is mortal. So we don't need to test the conclusion to find out whether it's true. If our premise is true, we don't need to find it. We don't need to give Socrates the hemlock to find out to know the conclusion is true. We can deduce it from the premise. Incidentally, do you all know Socrates' last words? I drank the what? But, well, enough of that. Okay, so the question is, I said, well, in deductive reasoning, the premises are true and we reason correctly, then the conclusion is true. But that raises the question, how do we know that the premises are true? And in Austrian economics, we know the premises are true because the premises are about the concept of action. You can just think about the concept. We have this knowledge of action just because we act ourselves. So we can think about what's involved in action. And then we deduce various conclusions from what we come up with. So if we're right, we don't have to test the conclusions because we deduce these conclusions from our knowledge of concept of action. So we don't have to go around testing this. And just like, suppose I come up with a conclusion, say an exchange involves a double inequality. Well, if I'd reasoned correctly, I'd say, well, this is involved in the concept of exchange. I don't have to go out and test this because I've shown it's involved in the whole concept. Now, this fact that Austrian economics says you don't have to go in for testing has made Austrian economics very unpopular with mainstream economists. They say, no, you have to test all your hypotheses. And they think that the Austrian method is dogmatic. They say, well, look, Austrian economics is just saying, look, here are these truths that are self-evident. You can't deny them. They don't test it. So look how bad the Austrian economics are. I think Paul Samuelson, who was the famous economist with MIT, I think he lived to about 150 years old, he died a few years ago, just when he reads von Mises on the a priori nature, now a priori means you just know something, just like that, but when he reads Mises on this, he says, I tremble for my science. Of course, some of his predictions, some Samuelson didn't write in for critical testing, some of what he said didn't turn out so well. He thought that the Soviet in the 1950s thought the Soviet economy was more productive than the U.S. So he went in for empirical testing, but he wasn't often his predictions didn't always come out so well. Now, I now want to deal with an objection to what I've been giving as the Austrian method. I said that the Austrian method is we start from premises that we know are true, and then if we reason correctly, then the conclusions are true, so we don't have to worry about testing them out because we're starting from true premises and we reason correctly, so you don't need to test them out. So the objection is, doesn't science sometimes show that our ordinary common sense beliefs are false? For example, doesn't it seem to us right now that the Earth is stationary, we're not moving? If you suddenly felt you were moving, and maybe it could be an earthquake or something, this wouldn't be a normal situation. So doesn't it seem to us that the Earth is just stationary? We look at the sky, we'll see the sun, the planets revolve around the Earth. But science shows this isn't the case, so we have here kind of an ordinary common sense belief, but it's not true. Doesn't science overthrow our common sense belief? So the argument is, well, look, Austrian economics can say, look, we have these common sense beliefs about how the world works, but they can still turn out to be false. Maybe there's something we're overlooking, just like science can overthrow our common sense beliefs about that the Earth is just is just motionless. Now, I would contend this example about how science overthrows common sense beliefs doesn't show that our knowledge of actions, kind of inside knowledge, since we know we're acting things about action just because we're people who act ourselves. These examples don't show that the Austrian conclusions could turn out to be false, because let's look at how our common sense beliefs about the world, say about how the Earth is stationary, could turn out to be false. Well, here in the physical case, there's a difference, there's room for difference between how things seem to us and how they really are. We can say, well, it seems to us that the Earth is stationary, but for various reasons, it turns out that it isn't. But there's, in Austrian economics, we don't have this difference between appearance and reality. Since we're acting, we know we're acting, we don't have any distinction between how action seems to us and how it really is. So there's no room for this, some other discipline to come in and say, look, this is just how things seem, but it really isn't that way. We can draw this analogy in science. Supposing there was some physical theory that said, it's false that it seems to us that the Earth is stationary. There would be something wrong with that theory, because it does seem to us the Earth is stationary. So a scientific theory couldn't show that things aren't really what they seem. It could show that things aren't what they seem to us, in the sense that how they seem to us isn't the way they really are. But the theory couldn't show that how things seem to us isn't the way they seem to us. You see, the distinction is in economics, there's no difference between the appearance and the reality. So that's why we can't use this kind of example, saying, well, look, science can show our common sense beliefs are false, to upset the conclusions of Austrian economics. There just isn't this distinction between appearance and reality. I'll just say, kind of as a matter of interest, I have met a few people who think the Earth really is stationary. I remember there was a fairly well-known clergyman, R.J. Rushdoony, who held that belief. I don't know if maybe you're familiar with his work. He didn't write on it, but that was one belief he had. And he split with his son-in-law. His son-in-law may have read on the Mises blog and Lou Rockwell, Jerry Norris as his son-in-law. Jerry Norris did accept Copernican astronomy, so he quarreled with his father-in-law. I think that was one of the points they differed on. But that won't be on the quiz. Just thought I'd mention that. Why not? My slide didn't change. What is it? Here we go. Now, I want to give another objection to what I've been saying. I said that Austrian economics follows ordinary or common sense reasoning. I said I'm contrasting Austrian economics and say it's easy to follow just common sense reasoning, thinking about what's involved in the concept of action. And I contrasted this with the mathematical economics, which is very difficult. But the objection is, well, if you read, say, the first 100 pages of Mises, you'll find this a lot of talk about synthetic a priori truths, analytic statements. Well, actually, Mises doesn't say synthetic a priori. He talks about a priori truths. If you look at on top of, we talk about synthetic a priori truths, analytic statements. Find all this very complicated, seemingly complicated philosophical terms. So that doesn't sound like ordinary language. I mean, if you go out on the street, you don't find too many people talking about synthetic a priori truths unless you're at a meeting of the American Philosophical Association. So how can I say that Austrian economics is all common sense reasoning that's using all these technical terms? But what you have to realize here is that these terms, synthetic a priori and analytic, that Mises and other Austrian writers at Rothbard use, this is just part of a philosophical defense of the Austrian method. When Mises was writing, there were influential philosophers in Vienna were trying to famous Vienna Circle, who were saying the way you do Austrian economics is all wrong, and they had a tax on Mises based on their philosophy. So Mises wanted to defend what he was saying, and he had to use philosophy himself. But these philosophical terms are just part of the defense of the Austrian method against critics. So you don't have to study them to do Austrian economics. You don't have to learn all this complicated terminology to do Austrian economics. This is just how it's involved in how Austrian economists would reply to particular philosophical attacks against what they're doing. But you don't need this if you're doing the Austrian economics itself. So I can say without, I can meet this objection and say, well, you don't need to know this to do Austrian economics. So it's still true that Austrian economics is following ordinary common sense reasoning, you see. Now, I gave an example of how we do common sense reasoning. Is one where we think about what's involved in the concept of an exchange. And we say, well, an exchange would take place only if I value what I'm getting more than what I'm giving up. And you're making an exchange with me, you value what you're getting more than what you're giving up. And we're only going to make an exchange if we have reverse preferences, so there's a double inequality. And I want to give another example of common sense reasoning in economics. And this is, reading for this week, you've got from Henry Hazlitt's book. This is one of the most famous chapters in the book. This is an example that Hazlitt took over from the great 19th century French economist Frédéric Bastiat, what was one of the great French classical liberals. The example is, supposing there's a young man who tosses a brick through a store window, just walking along, picks up a brick, hurls it through the window. So you might say, oh, well, that's when you start with juvenile delinquent, like, done something really bad. But someone says that the boy is really a public benefactor. In what way? Well, what's going to happen when the shopkeeper sees he has a broken window? He's going to have to pay to have his window replaced. So he's going to give money to the glassmaker. Then the glassmaker will spend the money he gets on other products, or just buy things like maybe he'll pay off the boy for breaking the window, and then the boy will spend money on something else. So there'll be a whole chain of spending that'll go on, and this will lead to more production jobs. So the boy is thrown the brick through the window, and then the shopkeeper pays to have the window replaced, and this will generate all sorts of spending throughout the economy. So the boy is really a public benefactor. He's got the economy going again. Let's see, the slide doesn't. Oh, not good. The slide changed. I always like it if the slide changed when I click on the button. Now, again, we don't have to use math to find out what's wrong with this reasoning. And the problem is that the reasoning doesn't consider everything relevant. Specifically, in this argument, remember the argument of the boy has thrown the glass, the brick through the window, broken glass, so the shopkeeper has to have the window fixed, and then he's spending, giving money to a glassmaker. The glassmaker will spend the money on other things, so it's generating all the spending. So we didn't ask, though, what would have happened if the boy hadn't broken the window. Well, then the storekeeper would have spent the money used to replace the window on something else. He wouldn't have had to buy a new window. He could have just spent it on something else. So then, say, spend it on, say, buying some candy. Then the candy store owner would spend that money on something else. So you'd have someone asked, how would insurance affect this? Well, probably that would mean somebody else would be paying to have the window replaced. So I don't think it would change the analysis much, but it's a good question. That's the kind of question I would have asked. All right, so it isn't the case then that throwing the brick through the window is going to help the economy, because we haven't considered that the shopkeeper would have spent the money on other things, would have saved the money, and then say the money would go in the bank, and the bank would give it to people to invest. So we have these two situations then, where the boy has thrown the brick through the window, that results in certain kinds of spending, and then we have the other situation where he doesn't do that, and the shopkeeper will just spend the money on other things. So can we say, is either situation better or worse than the other? Say, well, we just have different spending patterns. One is the boy is throwing the brick through the window. That will result in certain pattern spending that starts with the replacement spending for getting a new window. And the other one is that the shopkeeper is just spending on other things. So maybe we can't say the boy is a benefactor, but maybe we can't say he's a benefactor, but could we say he hasn't done any harm because all we have is different patterns of spending? We can't really say one is better than the other. They're just different, obviously. The glassmaker would be happier in the first the case where the boy is throwing the brick through the window, and the people that the shopkeepers would have spent money on will be happier in the case where he doesn't. So what's different, though, is in the first case, there's been a destruction of wealth. We have the broken window. So that's how, so really, the boy, as we would suspect in common sense, really has done something bad. He's destroyed wealth. He's destroyed a useful object. When we replace the window, then we're just back to where we were before. So he really has done something that's an impediment to production. Now, you might think this is kind of a very simple-minded fallacy. You know, nobody's going to commit the broken window fallacy now. I just use it as an example to show how we can reason about economics in a common sense way. But people do commit it. For example, Paul Krugman, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. I think he's the current Nobel laureate. He said right after the 9/11 attack, well, the destruction caused by the attacks on the World Trade Center would lead to increased spending and more production. I guess he's gotten into trouble in the past few days for another column he wrote on the 9/11 anniversary. It was on something else. So apparently, whenever he writes about 9/11, he gets into difficulty. So Krugman is committing this fallacy. He's saying, well, look at all these buildings were destroyed. Look at all the damage. This is bad. But look at all the spending we'll be getting because people will be having to replace all these things. And he's forgotten that Well, if they hadn't had to replace all these things, they would have spent the money or saved or done something else with it. We got in a situation is worse from an economic point of view because we've had all this destruction of property. And Krugman isn't the only one who committed this fallacy. We find that many proposals for government spending ignore what people have done with the money if the government hadn't taxed it. Wait, I was watching last week President Obama was giving a proposal to have more jobs that involved the government spending a great deal of money to on building infrastructure. Infrastructure is the word they like. They like a lot. We have to repair all the roads and do other highways and other things. So what this isn't taking account is, well, what would the people have been doing with the money? Say they do this, is what would the people have been doing with the money if the government hadn't spent it? Wouldn't they also be investing it or spending it? Now, there's one complication here that I'm not going to go into because, again, this is elementary course, which I've been with easy stuff. There are some Keynesians who say, or Keynes said, we know all about the broken window fallacy, but if you have unemployment, then the broken window fallacy isn't a fallacy because why not? Because they say, well, the way this argument is working is it's saying if people, if there wasn't this destruction, then people would have spent the money on other things. But they say if there's any unemployment, this indicates people aren't spending the money. They think people are just kind of hoarding the money. They're keeping the mattress and they're not spending it on anything. So they say, look, it's not a fallacy because there isn't this alternative spending that people would have been spending things on. Now the Austrians become say, no, this isn't very plausible at all. If people have money, they're not, except for a short time, they're not just going to just hold on to it, not do anything with it. They're going to spend it or save it. So I just want to mention that some, it's just a complication, but the basic fallacy we can see is that you're not, the window fallacy, you're just not taking account of all the relevant information. Broken window fallacy is just saying, well, look, this destruction will result in increased spending, but it's not asking what about what would happen without the destruction. Now, I now want to deal with another topic, and we'll be going into this in much more detail next week, where Austrian economics has a very different view from mainstream. This has to do with competition. This is the Austrian view of competition is very different from the neoclassical view. Now, one way we can think of, get the sense of the Austrian view, we can think of consumers on the market as having dollar votes. Of course, if they're not in dollar economy, they just be a different monetary unit. And we think that our money are kind of giving us votes on different things, and the sellers are competing for these votes. They want, the seller wants people to spend money on this product, so they're trying to attract these dollar votes to their product. So someone said, neoclassical is saying is mainstream. That's an excellent question. Yes, that. Right, the mainstream view, what's the dominant view, is this neoclassical view. And I'm going to be going next time, we're going to a bit more detail than what exactly the neoclassical view is of competition. So in the Austrian view, all sellers of products are in competition for dollars with consumers because you can spend your money on any product that's available depending on what you want. So competition in the Austrian view isn't confined to firms within a particular industry. So it's all the firms and industries are competing for the dollar votes, the money that consumers have. And then similarly for production goods, the various people who are spending money on those goods, all the production goods would be in competition with each other. Now, so Mises compares market competition to a political democracy, saying political democracy, people are voting on which person they'd like to be president. They have a candidate people are voting on. And Mises compares market competition to political democracy and says the market is better than political democracy because in an election, then say you have a winner, you have one winner and then the other people are losers. So supposing, say, in the last election, supposing you didn't vote for Obama, then you've lost out. You don't get the person you want. But in the market, it isn't just one product wins and all the rest lose. If you have taste or want things that most people don't want, you can still get what you want as long as you can find people to supply what you want and who can cover their costs. So supposing, say, you have some taste that most people don't like, say, you want to get books on, you like to get first edition of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, as long as you can find people who are selling that, you'll be able to get that, even though most people wouldn't want it. Maybe I should say first edition Atlas Shrugged in this audience. So Mises says, look, the market's much better than democracy because as long as you can find somebody who has who can sell what you want, you'll be able to get it. It isn't just only the people who are in the majority will be able to get what they want. So in a political democracy, only the winning party gets what it wants. Now you can have some democratic system have what they call proportional representation, where say you have parties represented according to the percentage of votes they get. But that in that system leaves many people unsatisfied. Some people don't get enough votes to get into the legislature. And still, once you have a legislature, then they're going for majorities. A lot of people are unsatisfied. In the market, you really can get what you want, even if your tastes or preferences are very much in the minority. Now, what about competition within a particular industry or sellers of the same product? For example, there are different companies that produce cars, sell food, and so on. We can have people sell services like doctors and lawyers, and people within a particular industry or sellers of the product are competing for the consumer's money. So these people are more directly in competition with one another than they are with all sellers of products. Say you have somebody who's producing, manufacturing a car, so then, it's, as I said before, he's competing with all sellers of products to get the consumer's dollar. He's particularly competing with other people who are selling cars. So you see there's a more direct competition within a particular industry. Now, Austrian economics, as I mentioned, differs very much on neoclassical economics from neoclassical economics on competition within an industry. As you'll see in detail next week, neoclassical economics imposes very strict conditions for a competitive industry. They say, in order to have a competitive industry, you have to meet very tough conditions. And basic thing is there have to be a lot of firms in an industry for competition to exist. If there isn't, if there, this condition doesn't exist, there aren't a lot of firms, then we have either case of monopoly, just one seller of a good, or oligopoly, which means a few sellers, let's say you have two or three people or something, or you can have a case of monopolistic competition. This means there are more sellers in the oligopoly, there's more than just a few, but not enough for competition, what's called perfect competition. And you say, we'll go into the particular terms in more detail next week. But the Austrian view is different. If my slide didn't change, what's wrong here? Let's try it again. Ah, here it goes. So Austrian economics doesn't impose these requirements. Neoclassicals are saying you have these, yes, monopolistic competition sounds a bit paradoxical. That's the term. It's sometimes called imperfect competition. So Austrian economics doesn't impose these requirements. In the Austrian view, as long as firms are free to enter and leave an industry, it counts as competitive. So you don't need to have these requirements on how many firms there are in an industry for a competition. It's just as long as the firms are free to enter and leave, then you can have a competitive industry. Someone asked for a real life example of monopolistic competition. Suppose you have, say, what people want, selling cars. There are various manufacturers of cars, but they don't meet the terms of the neoclassical requirements for perfect competition. There aren't enough of them. So some of the firms can influence, a firm can be big enough to have some influence on the price. So that would be another good case. So why is there this difference between the Austrian economics that arguing for competition is firms are free to enter and leave the industry, and neoclassical have these very strict conditions. Basically, this is one of the key points we have to understand in Austrian economics. It takes people's choices on the market as given. It doesn't try to improve on people's choice by saying they don't meet the terms of some non-market standard. It doesn't say, well, there's something inefficient or wrong with the way people are choosing on the market. They could be improved in various ways. But Austrian economics just takes whatever preferences people have or give it. The neoclassical economists, on the other hand, think that they can improve on the market. They think if the market doesn't meet their standards for competition, remember that these are different standards from the Austrian view, they say, and the market isn't efficient. What do they mean by efficiency if the market is inefficient? And by this they mean, briefly, the maximum production at the least cost. Now, to understand what they mean by this, we have to understand the notion of utility. So in the Austrian view, again, remember, we're starting from action. And we all act. We use means to achieve ends. So when you're acting, you're trying to achieve the goal that you value most highly at the time. Supposing, say, your goal is to understand Austrian theory, so you might say, well, what you do achieve that, so you want to read Henry Hazlitt. So you have your goal, and then you say, how can I achieve that? So you can rank economic goods by how they will help you achieve your goals. Some goods will help you achieve your goal. Say, well, what is my top goal? What are the goods available? What will best enable me to achieve my top goal? And then other goods will help me achieve lesser goals. So I can rank the goods in how they will help me achieve my end. So supposing I seem to like apples, even though they tend to make me sick, I gave examples of apples. Suppose you have 5 apples. So you ask yourself, what is the best use I have for the first apple? Then you ask this question for each apple, what is the best use I have for this one? So the value you get from the good is called its utility. So you're saying the value, say the first apple being eating it, so that's the utility of the apple. What is its use to you? That's what they mean by the utility. So suppose you get more and more units of a good, you'll use it to fulfill lower ranking ends. Say you're going to your first unit of good, you'll fulfill your highest ranking goal, best thing you can do with it. And then as you get more units, you'll use them for lower ranking ends. So this is called diminishing marginal utility. It means that the marginal or last unit decreases in value as you add more units. This is a basic principle of economics, diminishing marginal utility. And I should say, someone put in diminishing marginal return. Well, that's something else that has to do with production. This is has to do with consumption. Your utility, what you're getting from the good, will go down because you're using each unit to fulfill a less value goal. You're going to use what you have to meet your highest value then first. It would make sense to, if you had an apple, say, just to use it for something that wasn't your highest value and for that. So, as I say, each person will rank units of the good in order depending on the unit uses he has for each unit. So very important to realize these units aren't measured on a common scale. It isn't that I'm saying, well, there's some kind of substance out there like utility, like units of happiness. I'm saying this good has so many units of happiness production. So it gets a utility of 5, this one has a utility of 3. It isn't something like I'm measuring some substance that's in the economic good. I'm just ranking them in order. I cannot say the apples all have some substance in common. Say the first apple has more of this good substance than others. But I'm not doing that. I'm just ranking them in it, because one is higher than the other, depending on the use I can put them to. So this is called an ordinal scale, first, second, third. Somebody says ordinal versus cardinal. It sounds like a potential quiz question. Well, I don't think you'll be surprised when you see the quiz that you think that. So very important to get this distinction. Ordinal just means first, second, third. But cardinal scale would be the units I'm measuring in, measuring, I can say, how I'm trying to measure certain substances, how much water is in this cup. I can come up with a measurement. There's a quart, there's a pint of water in this bottle. This isn't light, it's just an ordinary measurement. Here's the first thing, this rank kind of second, so on. So if that's right, if we're just using these ordinal measurements, then you can't make comparisons of utility between persons. It wouldn't make sense to say that my first choice on what to do with an apple ranks higher than your second choice. It's higher to whom? All we would have is ranking a particular individual. Cardinal. Yes, Michael, but cardinal you quantify. Yes, you're measuring, particularly measuring an amount of something. That's right. Now, the neoclassical economists largely accept what I've been saying. You probably thought I'm going to be saying, well, neoclassicists think you can measure interpersonal utility and Austrians say, no, that isn't right. Most neoclassicals say, it's right, you can't measure interpersonal utility. But they think they can still show that if their conditions for competition aren't met, remember, this means you have to have a lot of firms, but I'm going to go into more detail next week exactly what they say. They say you can show that utility will go up. There's a way to increase utility if their conditions for competition aren't met. You'll be able to increase utility. And we'll be seeing next week how they claim to do that. So what the Austrian response here in brief is that we can't know other people's preferences. All we can know is we see what they've done in a particular case, and we know what they prefer to do, whatever it might be. But we can't get information the way the neoclassical people want to do about people's rankings of things. The neoclassical thinks, well, if we know all the various things about people's rankings, then we can show how to increase utility by changing things so we can get the condition of perfect competition. We also think, no, we can't know these things. Now, last point I want to cover is a question you might have wondered when I was saying that the Austrians take all markets as competitive as long as there's free entry and exit. And I'm going, what about a case where you have just one seller, a monopoly? How can a competitive market have one seller, just one seller? Well, in the first place, remember, the seller is still competing with sellers of all other goods. He doesn't have monopoly on everything. And then, more important, Murray Rothbard says, even if you just have one seller, there's no way to establish that the price he's charging isn't a competitive price. Suppose you say, well, wouldn't the price be lower if there were more firms in the industry? His answer is, maybe it would be, but why should we say that price would be the competitive price, not the price of monopolist insurance? So basic point he's making when I mentioned before, he's saying if we try to come up with a conditions for a competitive price, I mean what the market, free market is established, we're trying to impose an arbitrary standard on the market. We're not taking people's preferences as given. But Mises' position here is slightly different. He thinks that the notion of monopoly price does make sense, but he basically isn't that far apart from Rothbard, because he said first that monopolies on a free market wouldn't come up very much, they just come up very rarely, and it would be very difficult to show that a firm was charging monopoly price, so there would be really no foothold to come in and say, look, we can change things so we can increase utility, so we're doing, we can improve on the market. Okay, well, I think that will be it by now. So I see some questions. Now, there's one here. What about classical saying that price is perfectly competitive when consumer surplus equals zero? Well, this is the kind of thing we'll be talking about next week. See, what the Austrians would say here is that the notion that we could figure out what a consumer surplus is would require us to have knowledge of people's preference scale in a way that we can't actually have. All that we're given is what people actually choose. So this new classical thing is just unrealistic because we're assuming that we have knowledge of people's preference scales apart from what they demonstrate in action. So you're quite right that that's what the new classicals would say, but the Austrians would say, well, you can't apply that. And we'll see next week there are other criticisms we can make of what the new classicals say. Okay. Now let's see, do we have any others? Someone says, what if there are only one gasoline refiner? Well, remember, you might have such a case, but if he starts charging enormous prices, then other people will try to get in the industry and put him down. So, you would not really come up with a case where somebody, all she knew is that if you have somebody who's a novice in sensitive, really charging enormously high price and nobody can do anything, that would be a case where the state or someone has given him the legal power to prevent people from coming in. So the auction would be, when we talk about monopolies, that involve almost always a legal monopoly given to people in the industry. Okay. Chris says you want the iPhone more than your 200 bucks. They want your 200 bucks more than 1 or 8 million iPhones. Yes, that's right. That's what we mean. Example of the doubling quality. That was a very good case. Yes, that's right. So you're not going to make an exchange unless you'd rather have. You rather have what you're getting than the money. That's why you're spending the money on what you're getting. Yes, I think that's a good point we have here. If someone comes up with a new product, he'd be only Eric Reid, somebody comes up with a new product. Then, if it's popular, other people will get into the industry. So, see, then that's an example of why, even if you have just one firm, it's still competitive in the Austrian view, as long as other firms are free to enter the industry. So, the Austrian view competition doesn't try to impose any demands on the market. So, then, whatever comes up in the free market is competitive. Let's see. Someone asked me to go back to slide 9. Okay, let's see. Go back to slide 9. Let's see. Okay, it's okay. Slide 9. That's right, Ash. Okay, here we go. Okay, this is the slide. It's interesting you want me to explain it, because that was the slide I was a bit worried about, that maybe I was too difficult. Well, what I said was, supposing we're using means to achieve ends. We're thinking about what's involved in the notion of action. So it isn't, when we're thinking about action, it isn't there's some underlying reality different from how things appear to us. It isn't that what's really going on is something other than action that just seems to us that we're acting. What's really going on is something else. So our action is all that there is. See what I mean? There's no distinction there between how things appear to us and how they really are. But when we're studying physical science, there can be such a distinction. You can say, well, things don't seem to be moving now. The Earth doesn't seem to be moving, but in fact, it is moving. That makes sense. And just say, well, why are there good reasons to think that? But see, we don't have this gap between appearance and reality when we're studying economics. So if we don't have this gap, that's why it isn't a good objection to Austrian economics to say, well, look, you say these are common sense conclusions, but science very often shows that, well, our common sense beliefs are false. It doesn't apply here because there's no distinction between how things seem to us and how they really are. Now, does that help at all? Let me see who asked that. Help that. Oh my, this is stuck a bit here. Wait a sec. What's happening here? Hello? My computer just got stuck here. Can you still hear me? If the computer is getting stuck, here we go. Okay, good, I'm back. Let me see. Bill, did that help at all? Okay, and Bill said, raise the question. Wait, we had another point here. Wait, I didn't get this one. Somebody has a different question here. I see Eric has something on a kind of markup, and I didn't see what that was referring to. Wait, I'm getting stuck again. Oh, why is this getting me stuck? Wait, here we go. Yes, Nautilus has to worry about the possibility of substitution, that's right. Now, Bill wants to know, are Austrian hypotheses testable? Well, I mean, you can test them in the sense that you can see that they're true, so you'll see an exchange, you'll see there is this doubling quantum, but they're not, you won't be able to come up with observations that would show them false. So it is, they're not ones where you could come up with you won't be able to come up with cases, say where there's an exchange, but there isn't a double inequality. You can verify that the hypothesis is true, but you're not testing it in that you just have to find out whether it's true. You just reason that it is true. You don't have to then keep testing it. Let me give you an example. Say, suppose I said that I know that I exist. It's apparent to me that I exist. So I wouldn't have to keep testing that. I can say, well, that's hypothesis I exist, but maybe I really don't. It would just grasp right away that it's true. It wouldn't require testing to know that it's true. So I think mainstream economists are very uncomfortable with that sort of claim. They think, well, you know, if you're saying you don't need to test something to find out if it's true, that's very dogmatic, but I don't think it is. The Austrian view is it isn't, because we have this knowledge of concept. We can see how things have to be true just from the nature of the concept. Chris says, well, if Austrian economics is arguing against state interference, wouldn't it be self-defeating for politicians to support less government? Well, I guess that would put many of them out of the job, so that's probably one reason it isn't popular with most politicians. That's a good point you raised. I think I tried to answer the question, are Austrian hypotheses testable? I mean, they're testable in the sense you can find instances where they're true, but if the Austrian view is right, you're not going to come up with cases where they're false. So testable can mean something like so we want to make a decision to say something is testable, doesn't mean can you come up with actual examples of testable methods. But testable means, if it means something like, are there cases where you could concede that it's false, then it isn't testing. Suppose you say, I've got water in this cup I have here. I don't know if you can see it, I've got a cup here. I say it's water, that's testable. We could imagine there's something not other than water in the cup that doesn't have any water. So you come up with a situation where what I'm saying is false. But in the auction, you couldn't come up with cases saying there is an exchange, but there isn't a double inequality. Now someone was making a point about what I was saying about Rothbard. Isn't it true that competition always lowers price? Now that, well, you're certainly right that if you have firms in competition, one thing they can do is lower, one will might try to undersell the other. That doesn't always happen, it certainly can't. But the point here to realize is, if you say you just have one firm, that doesn't, the fact that say there would be, you could imagine a situation with other firms who might be charging a different price, doesn't show that the first price isn't competitive. And why would you want to, maybe you would want to say that, why shouldn't, and this is one question Rothbard said, but why shouldn't you equally say that, if you have firms trying to undercut each other, but then they're charging a sub-competitive price. What he's saying is, if you impose any standard other than what actually takes place in the market, then you're just putting in an arbitrary standard. So, well, competitive price has to meet such and such condition. But why should you say that? Why shouldn't you just say, whenever the market has, will be the competitive price? So, your point is a good one, that very often firms in, you have several firms in competition, one will try to undersell the other, but it doesn't really go against what Rothbard is saying. Let's see, Brian, well, this is a very good question. In economics, we're dealing with the action that doesn't involve coercion, but that's just the claim isn't that only action not coercion can be analyzed by this way of thinking about things. It's just that's the specific topic we're dealing with in economics, and we need to raise the possibility maybe you could have other branches of the science of human action called science praxeology, or you be studying coercion. It's a very good question. It's just that isn't what we're dealing with principally in economics, although sometimes we're studying coercion, say we're dealing with state intervention. But basically, we're trying to analyze non-coercive action. Bill says, wouldn't critics of religion say it can't be proved false? Well, that's right, probably that would be one criticism they could raise against certain religious faiths, but then the question would be, we still have a question about then, why would you accept a particular claim as true? I mean, supposing you have an argument that something must be the case, wouldn't that be a point in its favor? You think, well, not only is true, but it couldn't possibly be otherwise. You might say, look, there's something wrong with the argument. But if the argument is a good one, suppose you say, well, I've got this argument that shows this must be the case. Exchange must involve a double inequality, wouldn't that be the point in its favor, saying not only is it in fact, it always involves double inequality, but it has to. That seems like not a point against it, but a point in its favor. Of course, if you if you say, well, but look, isn't this kind of dogmatic? It's just saying this must be the case. Isn't that kind of a dogmatic claim? But are you saying something you can't criticize? Well, the way you criticize it is to show that there's something wrong with the argument. So it's still open to criticism in that you can try to find something wrong with the argument. It's just you don't have to test it in the sense of coming up with trying to say there must be, there are examples where there could be examples where it doesn't turn out to be right. I mean, so I don't think the fact that if you say something can't be proven false, that isn't necessarily a defect. It could be something very much in its favor. I think there's an ambiguity when you say can't be proven false. If you mean something like can't really be argued for, that would be something else. But the Austrian economists aren't saying that at all. On the contrary, they're saying, look, this can be established by argument. It isn't sort of some kind of, it isn't the Austrian economists are making kind of claims that, well, here's the way things are. You can't prove this is false, so we believe it. It's, they say, no, we have arguments to show that it must be true. You see the difference there. Yes, I think you're right, Ray. We do test the theory. We come up with, we can get illustrations of it, but we're not coming up with a case where we're thinking that could turn out to be false. Question, do people see what they want to see, what's the best way to draw their attention to the unseen thing? Well, I think you just have to go through, what you mean like a broken window, because you just have to present the argument in a way that people can follow. That's what I'm trying to do here. You know, I don't think you actually have to go out and break a window to do it. You just go through it. What I'm trying to show here is these arguments are fairly easy to follow. Maybe I present them in too complicated a way, but if you read Hazlitt, you'll see they're very easy to follow. And you can, I think, here we have a question about Marx. Had there been a case of natural monopoly? Well, you can have cases where there's single sellers of particular products, like, say, diamonds or gold. It's interesting you ask that question because I once, in a letter in 1966, I once asked Mises about the differences between his theory of monopoly and Rothbard's, and he thought there could be cases, some cases of natural monopoly. But see, then you have a question. You could have a case where there's a single seller of a good, but then you still have the question, could that seller charge a monopoly price? And that's the point. Rothbard's question, he said, no, we couldn't show that the particular price is not the price. Rothbard isn't denying you could have cases where there's a single seller of a good that could have a monopoly in that sense. But he's saying, why would we want to say the price they charge is a monopoly price? Yes, Jefferson, this is right. If the conclusion follows from the premises, then you don't need to test them. As long as you know the premise is true, you reason validly. That's a good point, Jeff. You'll do well in this class. Someone? Yes, I see we're coming up with cases where how monopolists could be driven out, if that's a good now here we have a question. When I say the Austrian government, someone says, couldn't we use statistics in premises and conclusions? Yes, you're certainly right, you could have statistical premises in deductive arguments, just in Austrian economic state tend not to do that. Remember, you're just reasoning about the concept of action. So we can have Austrian economists will use statistics when they're doing a particular historical case study, like say take Murray Rothbard on the Great Depression, will have a lot of use of statistics, but they tend not to come in the actual theory. But so we have maybe time for a couple more questions. Yes, Chris, if they're charging more than what other people think is fair, then it creates opportunity for other people to sell. Yes, I mean, if other sellers think that they can undersell what the first person is doing, then they'll get into the market. You're quite right. Let's see, maybe there's a question. Oftentimes we're finding predicting negative effects of state intervention in the market beyond saying something bad will happen. Didn't prediction result beyond the scope of Austrian economics? Well, I mean, you could identify certain types of things that will happen. We'll see that in detail when we're discussing minimum wages, tariffs. We can say specifically certain kinds of things will happen. We won't be able to come up with quantitative predictions, but we can do better than saying something bad will happen. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now, unless somebody else has something. I see there was a good debate on monopoly going on. Yeah, I see. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming to my lecture. Hope you'll all be here next week. Next week we're going to go into more detail on the neoclassical view of competition and what the Austrian, how it differs from the Austrian. And no, I didn't meet Mises, Michael. I just sent him a letter. I knew Murray Rothbard very well. And Hayek was one of my teachers. Unfortunately, I didn't meet Mises. I see we have some good people attacking Krugman. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming. I'll see you all next week. Bye everybody.